You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast. This is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is December 29th, 2016. We will be joined today on the podcast with Mark Laren Young. He is the author of The Killer Whale Who Changed the World. But first, I do have some sad news to share. On December 20th, a killer whale was spotted in Sechelt, British Columbia, unfortunately dead. And within just a few short hours, we learned that this whale was J34 Double Stuff, an 18-year-old male, part of J-Pod, part of our southern resident community of whales that are endangered. And so this is such a huge loss to these whales, especially J-Pod, that suffered a number of losses this year. Fortunately, a necropsy was performed right away, and so a lot of information will be coming out in the next few weeks and months about this whale and how he died. One thing that we do know is that there was some sort of blunt force trauma that to the head and the back of the neck region, and that very likely contributed to his death. In cases like this, a lot of the times the head of the animal is taken off and sent to be scanned with a CAT scan. And this will let us know if there were any bone fractures or anything like that. Some people have speculated that this whale was hit by a boat. If that was the case, then we'll likely see some fractures in his bones. And if that's not the case, and this is some other source, the CT scan will hopefully give us more information about what it could have been. We have only 2 days left for our Indiegogo fundraising campaign. We try to really just fundraise here at the end of the year, and so we push really hard to get all of our programs funded for 2017. And one thing that I'm very grateful for this year is our team of awesome volunteers who put in just a ton of heart and dedication, hard work in the tough weather that we have here in the Pacific Northwest. And these guys are out there watching whales from shore, helping others see whales for the first time. And then they're going beyond just watching whales to planting trees that will help our endangered salmon, feed our endangered whales. We just need so much more salmon in the water to help our whales. And I cannot do this hard work without all of them. And we are really wanting to invest in our volunteers and their education and their supplies and equipment in 2017. And we are also brainstorming a lot of other great ideas that will be put into action to help our whales. So go online to whalescout.org, and right there on the front page, you will see our Indiegogo campaign link. There are awesome perks up there, really fun items. If you didn't get what you wanted for Christmas, you might find it here. So check that out at whalescout.org. And up next, Mark Laren Young. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast. We are joined today by Mark Laren Young. He is the author of the great book, The Killer Whale Who Changed the World. How are you doing today?
Dandy.
Great. I love this book. I don't know if binge reading is a thing, but I just binge read your book. And
thank you.
You're welcome. And you know what I really enjoyed about the book is that you took this story about a whale that was brought into captivity sort of by accident and explained everything step by step. But then you also went on and talked about the current status of our killer whales, and you really did a great job bringing all the scientific facts and everything together. And so I cannot tell you enough about how much I enjoyed this book. But you are not actually a big time necessarily whale person. I mean, you've written several books, you're involved in theater. How did you get involved with the story of Moby Doll?
Well, I mean, I've been a journalist pretty much my entire life, and this is a weird one for me. I was interviewing Paul Watson from the Sea Shepherd back in 96, and I was interviewing him for a story from Maclean's magazine, which is, you know, Canada's major news magazine. about whales in captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium. And while we were talking, he said, you know, the Vancouver Aquarium is the first place that ever displayed a captive killer whale. And I found that fascinating. And then he started telling me the story of Moby Doll. And I did two things that I'd never done as a journalist before. One was that I actually decided I wasn't going to write about that in the claims. For some reason, I decided that story was for me. I just wanted to know more about that for me. And the other was that I decided I was just going to start researching this without any assignment at all. So I went to meet some of the key characters, and I was hooked.
And you talk a little bit in the book about this Moby Doll Symposium. Can you talk a little bit about that? And is that where you met a lot of the key figures?
Well, the Moby Doll Symposium was on Saturna Island. That was the 49th anniversary of Moby's capture. It was about 3 years ago now. I found out about the symposium when I was interviewing Murray Newman. Murray Newman was the head of the Vancouver Aquarium, and he was the guy who came up with the idea, which was back in 64, this was the story I found so hard to believe. Back in 64, people were so terrified of killer whales that they figured the only way they could possibly study one was to get a dead one. So the Vancouver Aquarium set out to kill a killer whale so they could do an accurate live model of a killer whale they were going to hang on the ceiling of the aquarium. And this was the story that blew my mind and really hooked me. And I interviewed Murray Newman about this back 20 years ago and kept trying to find places I could write the story. And nobody was into it. Nobody, in the age of Free Willy, nobody wanted to hear about harpooning a whale. And I just stuck with it. And I finally interviewed Dr. Newman just before the symposium, which I didn't know was happening. And he's the one who said, oh, you got to be coming to the symposium. But I met a lot of the key players at his house about 2 weeks before the symposium.
So for those who haven't read the book or don't know the story, so Dr. Newman went and he wanted this sculpture in his aquarium, and so they went to harpoon a whale, and then take it from here. What happened?
Well, what happened was they set out to harpoon a whale. They went to Saturna Island, which is the best place in BC to watch a whale from the shore. I gather for you it's Limekiln?
Yes, I would say yeah. So, but there's some so spots I, down so here too, but yeah.
So I guess it's our equivalent of Limekiln. And so Vancouver Aquarium went to Saturna Island and set up a harpoon right off the coast. And the plan was that as soon as the whale swam close enough to shore, they were going to take it out with this harpoon. And, you know, the wildest thing for me is that everyone was expecting a monster. You know, they were terrified of this, you know, horrific creature, the killer whale. So the expedition sort of arrived with a whole team, and the team quickly got bored, and you were left with two men, Sam Burich, who was a sculptor, and Joe Bauer was a fisherman. And Burich was assigned to use the harpoon gun. And finally, after almost 3 months, they surrendered on the expedition. They were no longer going to, they'd actually decided to close up, and they'd celebrated and gotten quite drunk the night before. And so they were packing up a tent when they spotted whales. For the first time in 3 months, the whales were close enough to shore to harpoon. And they raced down and harpooned what was a very young male. And when the whale was going under, something happened that completely shifted their perception of killer whales, like just in a moment, in a heartbeat. And that was that two larger killer whales raced at the whale that had been harpooned. And based on everything they knew about killer whales, they were expecting that these big whales would be ripping the victim to shreds. And instead, they were lifting it to the surface and helping it breathe. And that moment, the men switched from, at least at that moment, Joe Bauer decided he was not going to kill the whale. And so, you know, he actually put his boat between people on the isle, on Saturna Island, who were shooting at the whale and the whale in order to stop the gunshots.
one of my favorite parts in your book is when you talk about this moment where he goes up and he, for the first time, gets a really up close look at the whale. And yeah. he reports later in the media that he went out there to like finish the job and to shoot it. But once he saw the whale up close, he couldn't do it. And he said it would be like an execution. I mean, that's exactly what they were there for. I just found that so striking.
Well, the most amazing thing about this story was trying to go back to 1964 and imagine what these men saw. Because, you know, when I first heard the story that the Vancouver Aquarium set out to harpoon a whale, I thought, what kind of monsters would harpoon a lovable orca? And then I went back and I read the stories about killer whales that predate this. And basically, if you saw a killer whale before July 16th, 1964, and you saw it up close, you pretty much figured you were done for. And all you knew about these whales was they were monsters. They were going to kill you. The U.S. and the Canadian government shot at them. Fishermen shot at them. The American and U.S. military used them for target practice because they were monsters and they ate salmon, which made them even worse. So it was just stunning. Each of the men in the book basically had their moment of revelation where they went, this isn't a monster, and I'm not going to kill it. And it was stunning kind of finding the moment for each person where they went, no, there's something here, there's something special here. And not only am I not going to kill it, but I will do everything in my power to save it. So the sculptor, to me, the moment that haunted me and the moment that kept me on this story for 20 years, even when nobody wanted to, when I couldn't find a single place that was interested in letting me write about this in any medium, what kept me going was the image of Sam Burich, who was the sculptor, who not only harpooned the whale, but took 3 shots at the whale with a rifle to finish it off, because that was his job, becoming the world's first whale sitter and playing harmonica to the whale because he knew they were acoustic and he wanted to find a way to let it know it wasn't alone. So in order to let the whale know, they thought the whale, who they named Moby Doll, was a she, but in order to let her know that she wasn't alone, he would sit on this little raft each day and play the harmonica and whistle because that was the closest he could come to making orca sounds.
It's incredible just how quickly that happened with each of these characters and just the way that the entire city of Vancouver was just thrilled to see this whale.
Well, I mean, it wasn't just Vancouver. Scientists from around the world caught on to this. It was really amazing. When the whale was caught, when the whale who became known as Moby Doll was caught, CBC TV reported that the Vancouver Aquarium had captured a monster. They actually used the word monster. So that gives you an idea of where people were coming from. One of the more amazing stories I came across in the book, I can't recall, I've listened to your entire podcast, but I can't recall, have you interviewed Dr. John Ford?
No, I would love to, though.
He's awesome. He's the acoustics expert out of the Whale Research Station in Nanaimo in Canada. And he's the person who basically discovered that orcas have the individual dialects and languages. He was the key person for this. And he was one of the people who, Moby Doll was on display for exactly one day to the public. And he saw Moby as a 9-year-old boy. And what was really amazing to me was he had seen a killer whale before when he was on his dad's boat. And he remembered his being on his dad's boat when he was like a little kid, like 7, 8, 9. And the killer whales were coming to the boat, and they were all going to die. I mean, he and his family were convinced they were going to die. And then suddenly, there he is at 9 years old looking at this whale in a dry dock in Vancouver, going, this thing doesn't look too scary. And then he becomes the guy who's hanging out with the whales memorizing the sounds of the whales, especially the call of Moby Doll, and remembers that sound when he hears J-Pod. And this proves his theory that orcas have individual dialects.
Yeah, that was one thing that I learned in this book, was that Moby Doll was a J-Pod whale. And I had kind of thought about it in the past, you know, like, surely it was a southern resident, but could we have gone back and learned who this whale really was in the wild? And you talk a little bit about Granny, J2, in the book as well.
Yep. Well, it's kind of wild because you go, okay, looking at the ages of the whales, it's very possible that J2 was one of the two whales that rescued Moby. I mean, because assuming that, you know, Kim Balcom's right and Granny's over 100, she would have been one of the caretakers. So she very well may have been one of the whales that lifted Moby out of the water when Moby was drowning. What's wilder is I'm kind of going, and, you know, if they're wrong and Granny's a bit younger than we think, she could have been Moby's mom. I'm actually still trying to dig up, you know, some of the closer footage of, I found footage of Moby that hasn't been seen in 50 years, but I haven't seen any footage of the other whales yet.
Wow, that would be amazing.
I'm still hoping I'll find that out.
And then once Moby is sort of in captivity, she's not eating. And scientists are studying her and trying to figure out why she's not eating, if her wound will get infected. And I mean, this is all totally brand new. A whale had never been, or a killer whale had never been cared for in captivity like this. What other science, you know, was gained from her?
Well, it was kind of amazing as they sort of called everybody in. What really stuck with me about this story was realizing that this was really real life science fiction. This was first contact with an alien species. And the Vancouver Aquarium brought in everybody. The first scientist on board and really one of the key players in this whole thing was a guy named Dr. Pat McGeer, who was one of BC's most respected neuroscientists and still one of Canada's most respected neuroscientists. He's one of the world's experts on both concussions and Alzheimer's, and has a huge bank of brains. And so he joined the expedition for one reason. He wanted to see what a whale brain looked like. He wanted to see what a killer whale brain looked like. And it was interesting because he was one of the first people who said, you know what, I'd rather study its intelligence than its brain. So let's keep it alive. And so they brought, there were acoustic researchers brought in from Harvard. There were researchers brought in from the University of Washington who were trying to do blood tests. So everybody was trying to figure out, like, what is a whale's blood like? What are the organs like? Any test they could possibly run medically, they were trying to run. But they had no idea. The big experts were sort of from, I think it was Marineland of the Pacific. And, you know, one of their expert opinions was that despite the fact that several people were pretty sure they'd seen a penis, they saw a dorsal fin that told them the whale was male, or whale was female. And, you know, we did the typical Canadian thing and decided that we'd better listen to the impressive American scientists and ignored the divers. I think that's a penis. No. The American experts from Marineland say it's female. So Moby was misidentified as female for, you know, until after the autopsy or after the necropsy.
And I always wondered, you know, they gave her such a sweet Moby Doll name. And you could, you know, in your book, you kind of travel through time and you see public perception changing in the headlines of these stories. And they really kind of give her a personality. And I wonder if they hadn't thought she was a girl, do you think that people's perceptions would have been different if it was a boy and it was this sort of still tough killer whale?
It's hard to know, but I think basically Moby Doll made the whale sound really sweet. I mean, it was a sweet name, and the female thing, you know, getting the gender wrong, actually, they sort of anthropomorphized even more.
Right.
In some really classically 1964 sexist ways, but yeah, that's partly how the public got to know this whale was, you know, there were references to her feminine temperament and things like that.
Right, and she acted like a lady.
it was funny looking at some of the old stories, and it was news that a female reporter from Life magazine showed up. So the fact that she was a woman was of note to other newspapers. So that puts you back in the air as well.
But not everyone was thrilled about a whale in captivity. There was a small contingent that disapproved.
Yeah, absolutely. That was also interesting, was finding out about some of the earliest, the sort of earliest activists. It was mostly people who'd worked with the SPCA, you know, out of Vancouver, Victoria, who were protesting. But what was really interesting was that there was a journalist who had covered the original capture, Jack Scott, who had gone out and talked about the hunt for a monster and was so excited about capturing the monster. And once the monster was in captivity and turned out to be the lovable being that we all know as orcas, he lost his heart for all of it and was going, you know what, as soon as you finish taking your tests, please do the right thing and set this well free. So, you know, there was a real shift even there. I mean, it was fascinating tracking different people's reactions.
And once the Vancouver Aquarium had a whale, it seemed like everyone wanted a whale.
Oh, absolutely. From the moment the whale, basically, the moment Moby didn't try and kill everyone, which was the anticipated reaction, there was interest from pretty much anyone who ran anything resembling a marine park suddenly wanted their own killer whale. And, you know, one of the pivotal moments really in kind of what happened with the orcas was that Seattle's Ted Griffin was there on the first day that Moby took food. And Griffin became, I think he was the second person ever to feed Moby Doll. So the second person ever to, you know, be feeding a killer whale. And that moment was pivotal for him in terms of going, okay, my dream of having a killer whale in captivity is viable. So, you know, one of many moments with Moby that you go, wow, that changed an awful lot. So Ted Griffin, for, you know, I mean, the listeners who don't know, was the guy who ran the Seattle Aquarium who, you know, purchased Mamu, who became, you know, the first big famous captive whale who stayed alive for about a year in Seattle. And Mamu led to Shamu and led to, well, where we ended up with orcas in captivity.
And now I have to ask you, what are your thoughts about captivity today? You know, facilities like SeaWorld.
My main thought is that I'm so much more concerned about the orcas in the wild. I worry that somehow so much passion for these incredible beings gets channeled into Corky or Lolita or Tillicum that we forget about, to my mind, the 80 southern residents who are a unique and irreplaceable culture. And I would so much love to see the energy going there to taking out the dams that'll bring back the salmon that allow these whales to stay alive, to doing what's necessary to stop pipeline expansions that are going to make it impossible for them to hear each other. So I worry that in some ways orcas in captivity become a distraction from protecting the entire species from the orcas in the wild.
Yeah, my personal opinion is right there on track with you. I mean, it would be amazing to see all of the time and energy and passion and dollars, you know, spread out over 80 individuals that are, you know, our last hope, right, for them to breed and have babies and to continue. So I love that even after studying and learning so much about this first captive whale, you haven't lost sight of the issues that we are facing today that you highlight again in your book. I want to talk about Moby's death. And in the book, you describe that she went up sort of for her last meal after this encounter where other whales swam past her enclosure. And yeah. It seemed like they had a conversation. And then she took her last meal and went underwater. And that was it. And she drowned. Do you think this was like an intentional like suicide?
No, suicide, no. Do I think that Moby had just run out of fuel? Absolutely. I mean, everything, the water, you know, the whale basically ran out of energy because the water that he was in, you know, being polluted water off the coast of the city, which was not meant to keep a whale buoyant. What was amazing was hearing that story from Joe Bauer. Joe Bauer was the fisherman who he's referred to, if you go back to books that mention Moby or the newspaper stories of the day, he's just referred to as the assistant if he's mentioned at all. And he is a very private and quiet individual. And I've been trying to get him to speak with me for years. And I did a radio documentary on Moby, and he wouldn't participate with that. I did a radio documentary. I did a feature for one of Canada's top magazines called The Walrus on Moby. He still wouldn't talk to me. After both of those, he decided I was okay because I was clearly trying to get the story right. And we finally spoke, and he's the one who told me about this last encounter. And he spent so much time there with Moby and, you know, kind of was there for every moment of it, and just hearing from him about the whales visiting that last time was just heartbreaking.
Yeah, absolutely. It's was a beautiful part of your book, and as the story went on with all of these characters and them being so excited that Moby was finally eating and it seemed like a permanent home was on the way, and then she died. I mean, it was heartbreaking for each of those characters.
What was really astonishing is that, you know, I mean, I have been following all you know, all the stuff, all the anti-captivity, not the anti-captivity, the plans to sort of bring Lolita or Corky back and create sanctuaries. What's fascinating was that the proposal that Marie Newman had for where a whale should be kept really resembled that sort of sanctuary. It was quite stunning that what they thought they should do with an orca or a killer whale and what they ended up doing were two entirely different things.
Do you mean by having...
Well, when the Vancouver Aquarium eventually was... When the Vancouver Aquarium eventually did have captive killer whales in the aquarium for the first time, they put them into a pool that wasn't designed for them. And they knew all along that was the wrong sort of place to put a killer whale. They'd always wanted... You know, the hope was to do something oceanside where the whale would actually have some freedom or something... Well, relative term, but... compared to the tanks that they're normally displayed in.
The Vancouver Aquarium went on, and they still house some cetaceans. And just recently in the news, I saw that their last two belugas have died. It's devastating to hear that story. What's going on now with the Vancouver Aquarium? It seems like it's controversial all the time with them housing cetaceans.
Well, it's interesting because when I've talked to various orca experts, they keep coming back to the Vancouver Crane's an interesting case because they feel like when, in like the initial study that Eric Hoyt did of whales in captivity, he listed the Vancouver Crane's as pretty much the only place that actually did anything resembling scientific research with the whales. When I interviewed Paul Watson, he said pretty much the same thing, that while he wasn't keen on orcas in captivity, Vancouver Aquarium was doing as well as it could be done. This is back in 96, so I'm not trying to speak for him now. But going back historically, the interesting theory I came up with was that from several people was that there's only really ever been one Shamu, so Shamu never dies. With the Vancouver Aquarium, everybody knows every time an orca is, every time one of the cetaceans is sick or dies because they're all introduced individually. And they're all sort of, also the interesting thing is the Vancouver Aquarium, isn't tourist based. It's local based. So you get people who get to know each individual creature. Like you actually, if you're from Vancouver, you have your favorite. You know, you tend to have your favorite aquarium exhibit. With me, I always thought the squids were pretty cool. You know, like different. So you get an identification with the animals. So I'm not sure what they're up to now with the remaining dolphins, but you know, they've been captured. And I've been reading about them, believe it, but I'm not quite sure what's up with them, believe it. So I'm kind of reluctant to delve into that too deeply.
I have a mailbag question here from Kaylee.
And
she's, yes, she is familiar with the story of Namu and is less so about Moby Doll. And she wants to know, she says here, I do think Moby Doll changed people's views about killer whales, and it opened up a lot of money for people and desires to have killer whales in captivity. Do you think that the capture in captivity is the only way that people's attitudes could have changed? Or over time, do you think people would have learned more about them without having ever brought them into captivity?
It's interesting. I had a conversation with somebody else who's been looking at these whales and looking at the history of the West Coast whales. And you know, the reality of Namu is that, you know, Namu was the whale that everybody got to know, followed by Shamu. Namu was captured accidentally in a fisherman's net. Two whales were caught there. And if Moby Doll hadn't been caught, then what would have likely happened to those two whales that were caught in the fisherman's net is the fishermen would have walked outside with their rifles and executed those two whales, because that's what fishermen did with whales. So the problem, when I talk about Moby Doll, people immediately default to, oh, if those hunters hadn't, you know, if the Vancouver Aquarium hadn't captured Moby Doll, Moby Doll would have swam free and lived a happy life. No, more likely, if the Vancouver Aquarium hadn't captured Moby Doll, we would have wiped them out with rifles. About 10 years earlier, basking sharks, if you've ever heard of a basking sharks used to, you know, swim around in like groups of 100. And these were huge sharks that basically do nothing else but lay around. Like they're like tourists at an all-inclusive resort. They are utterly harmless unless you're a fishing net. And because these sharks damage fishing nets, the Canadian federal government approved taking them out and slaughtering them. So, you know, we put spikes on one of the Coast Guard vessels, and the Coast Guard vessel would ram up the basking sharks. The killer whale had been basically targeted the same way. There was a machine gun set up on Vancouver Island to take out killer whales for taking out the salmon. The same thing was happening in the U.S., on the U.S. side of the border. So, you know, I'm not sold that without Moby Doll ending up in that dry dock that we would have ever studied these killer whales. I've heard people argue, well, you know, all of the great research was done well. Yeah, and it was mostly done by people who saw, you know, astonishingly, a lot of it was done by people who saw Moby Doll.
Yeah, I mean, the list is like,
you know, Michael Big.
Yeah.
You know, Michael Big was studying pinnipeds before he met Moby Doll. So Michael Big, who's the person who's now who's responsible for us knowing about resident and transient whales, learned about whales because he was brought on to help feed Moby some of the seals he was studying.
Yeah, and you know, John Ford, Paul Spong, all the great pioneers in killer whale research saw Moby Doll.
It was stunning when I started putting the story back together and going, oh my God, John Ford, you know, the John Ford learned about language because he'd heard Moby Doll's calls. You know, Michael Big went into whale research after being drafted to both feed Moby Doll and assist with the necropsy. Like, you look back at the key players in our discoveries about the orcas, and all oceans lead to Moby Doll.
It's an amazing story. What are your hopes for Moby Doll's legacy going into the future?
Honestly, when I first started, you know, on this book, I never imagined that these whales would be so endangered. And, you know, my hope now, my hope with the book, my hope with all the stuff, all the work that I'm doing about the whales, I'm doing a documentary about Moby and also a documentary about Granny, J2. My hope is this will raise some awareness to keep the now 80 southern residents alive and vibrant. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to spend some time with them, and like you, I'm hooked, and I want to do whatever I can to help raise awareness about the species and keep this species thriving.
And if people want to learn more about your future documentaries and other work, where should we go to find out more about them?
I've set up MobyDoll.com, or look up LarenYoung.com. I'm on Twitter and all sorts of awesome social media sites, but MobyDoll.com or LarenYoung.com, you'll find me in the book.
And the book is called The Killer Whale Who Changed the World. I picked up my copy on Amazon. And
cool.
Yes, again, I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed reading the book. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for doing what you do, Whitney. I love your podcast, and I've listened to every episode, and I'm really excited to be on it.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you again for listening to the Whale Scout Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more and hear more episodes, go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast. They'll be sent directly to your phone. All episodes are free. And if you'd like to help keep them that way, I encourage you to go to our website to donate through our Indiegogo campaign. We are raising $5,000 at the end of this year towards next year's programs. And we have great perks still available, but hurry, this is your last 2 days to donate to this fundraiser and to get in your 2016 tax-deductible donation. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout Podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale-watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Ma la type est trop bien démodée, aussi mal coiffée qu'écrasée, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.